Hey, Correct Spare, Leak Project. How the heck are you? Today's guest is Paul Anthony Wallace. The podcast, Escaping Eden, a scary truth behind the original Bible story. Now, Paul is a popular speaker, author, researcher. He has written several books on spirituality, mysticism, and today his work probes world mythology, ancestral narratives for their insight into human origins and human potential. His book, Escaping from Eden, has been hailed by George Norrie as this generation's Chariots of the Gods. Paul hosts the Paul Wallace Channel on YouTube, also co-hosting The Fifth Kind TV in partnership with Gaia TV. Check out fifthkind.tv. I'm going to leave links to the YouTube channels in the video description box. And today, we're going to get deep into the origins of humanity, why we're here, the Bible story, the connections. Are people mistaking the idea of God with extraterrestrial memories? Now, before we get too deep into this, I want to show you something real quick. This is so cool. I just ordered four of these. Go directly to the website. The website is backupsolarbank.com. That's backupsolarbank.com. They're portable, solar-powered. You can charge your phone wirelessly. They require no additional batteries, no additional wires to charge the actual battery bank that has 20,000 microamps. These things are awesome. Also, you'll notice it has an extremely bright flashlight, and you can charge it faster if you plug it into a wall, or you can leave it on the dash. You can leave it out in the sunlight, and it will charge the battery bank. Now, if you use the code LEAK20, you'll get an additional 20% off. Go to backupsolarbank.com. Approximately 800,000 houses in the Northeast and Midwest lost power this year due to extreme weather and winds. Many forecasters are predicting even more extreme weather. Get yours today. Order several. They're great Christmas gifts also. That's backupsolarbank.com. Backupsolarbank.com with the code LEAK20, an additional 20% off. Now, let's go ahead and bring in Paul. I'm excited to hear about what he has to say, and I'm certainly excited for my autographed copy of his latest work, Scars of Eden, that's coming out shortly.
Yeah, having a good day.
Yeah, I'm loving the background there. That's a nice, clean-looking studio you got.
Oh, that's nice. It's a corner of our bedroom. My actual study is a through room, and the kids will arrive at some point in the through room, so I'm hidden away here.
I mean, it looks like you've got it specifically set up for podcasts. So,
great.
Right on, right? Now, dude, I just want to jump right in because I already did an intro, and I am super excited to get your new book that you got coming out early next year, Scars of Eden. And yep. Your first book you've got describing Eden is fascinating and, you know, very high level. I want to get into like the Anunnaki, man. I mean, are they coming back? A lot of people think they're coming back in March.
Oh, do they? Okay. Well, that will be interesting.
Wouldn't it? Get to work, you human slaves. Build our pyramids.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, my goodness. Well, they've already got us doing that, so I'm not sure what extra they're going to be asking.
Well, but I mean, I'm joking, but I'm not at the same time. I mean, there's a lot of people that...
Yeah, look, there's something, there is such an acceleration of disclosure happening at the moment. I can fully understand why, without any particular information, people would say something's about to happen, because it really does look like there's a lot of rearguard action prepping us for that. And if there's an acceleration of disclosure and therefore an acceleration of evident presence, what does that mean? Who are the ones who are going to be evidencing themselves? Because, as you know from my book, I believe there's a number of ET demographics involved in Project Earth. So who are the ones breaking rank? Who are the ones who are pushing this forward? And are they on our side or are they not?
So let's talk about it. With all the information that's been presented, even just a few days ago, there was the gentleman from Israel that was with the Space Command.
Chaim Eshed. Yes.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
That's a big deal.
It's a big deal because of who has said it. But it's really interesting that Hamershed is just the latest of a number of people who are one degree removed from being the person in the position of authority to make the announcement. So Hamershed is the former chief of Israel's space security program. And then we had Alain Juillet, the former head of French intelligence. You spoke to Paul Hellyer just recently, former Ministry of Defense for Canada, etc., etc. And I'm not saying that as a negative at all. I'm saying that's only one degree removed from the person in the position of authority making an announcement. That's really close to what we could say would be an official disclosure. And then there's what he's saying, which is really repeating what has been said by others. I mean, Ed Mitchell, from the 1970s until his death in 2016, campaigned for the USA to declassify its UFO files. And his argument is that it was time for us to take our place as a spacefaring civilization in a community of spacefaring civilizations. And so he's almost using that language of an intergalactic federation, which is the precise language Hamershed has used.
So what does it mean, man? I mean, where are we going with this? Is this a highly orchestrated disinformation campaign? Is this something that is going to get people on the ships that could end up who knows where? You know, because we're like, hey, we need to teach people more about ships. Hey, we're on Mars. Hey, they need our help. I'm like, you know, I want to go to Mars, but I don't want to end up being on the menu, you know?
Nicely put. Highly orchestrated, I'm not quite sure, because I think that these disclosures are happening in a rather interesting piecemeal kind of way. And I wonder if that's because the non-disclosure arrangement that our ET neighbors have had is not quite as secure as it's been in the past. And I wonder if our actions in terms of allowing these officials to come and speak is mirroring something that's happening among our ET visitors, that there's an untidiness to what's happening. There's an uncertainty about what's going to happen next. I'm not sure that a well-oiled, orchestrated process is really what we're looking at.
You see it more of just an organic set of circumstances that are presenting themselves?
I think that official statements acknowledging that we've got company are always plan B or plan C, and that the plan A is for much more careful and slow management of things than that.
Well, it's been 70 years since Roswell.
Yes, it has. It's been 70 years, but, you know, to be fair, the change in policy in the last, 2 years really, has been very dramatic, because we had that 70-year policy of silence and debunking that began in 1947 when Truman signed the National Security Act, which created the conditions for the foundation of the CIA, created the apparatus for silencing UFO examination. And then there was a bit of a process, I think it was 1969, that US defense shut down the apparatus by which reports of UFO sightings and encounters were brought and reported and processed. That was all stopped. So officially nothing was happening from 1969 on. And as you know, people who did report close encounters or UFO sightings were always debunked by people in official positions until the beginning of the 21st century. And then the debunking stopped. And then the big change really was 2017, when the New York Times ran with that story telling us all that the Pentagon had secretly had a department that was involved in researching UFO encounters and retrieved materials from UFO crashes. That was the fact-checked report from the New York Times. And then a year later, the Pentagon confirms it. And then we heard from Luis Elizondo, the person who headed up the Pentagon unit for 10 years. We heard from Chris Mellon, the former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. We heard from Eric Davis, who briefs that group that's part of U.S. defense. Then we heard from Alain Juillet, the former head of French intelligence, confirming all that. And so instead of the old pattern of someone's said they're going to be official after official backing the story up. And so that's a very sharp hoik to one side and really an abeyance of the old policy of silence. And anyone keeping their eye on the news would think, whoa, why has that happened? Why have they changed that policy? Not only have we had a constant drip, drip, drip of that kind of information, off-world vehicles, not made on this earth, or that kind of material, but at the same time, NASA has news almost on a weekly basis to prep us for the idea that we're in an inhabited, populated universe with signs of water on neighboring planets, signs of water on the nearest planet and the nearest solar system with an Earth-like planet. And then we've got greenhouse gases around Venus. And every so often, there's a story just saying, come on, guys, get ready. We're in a populated universe. And there's this sort of triangulation that's happening that really does look like it's leading towards some more significant disclosures. And maybe next time from people still in their positions of authority.
You know, and if that's the case, I always find it interesting the way they word some of these, like the verbiage, off-world craft not built on this earth. It makes me think, oh, so you built it on the space station. Well, I can't just come out and say, yes. It's alien, man. It's probably extraterrestrial. No, it's a craft that they built off Earth. Well, okay. Yeah. So are you following me here with the verbiage?
Because absolutely. It's a very particular form of words. Now, you know, if you really wanted to be pedantic about it and technical about it, what they're saying with that form of words is that when they examine the materials that they have, it's clear that they were engineered in zero G. That's the technical information there. But by whom? And as soon as you add that question, you realize it is an acknowledgement of an off-world civilization that you and I know nothing about. So it really is an acknowledgement of another advanced civilization in our airspace, even if off-world, if I can put it that way. So it is a very, very significant disclosure that that form of words was authorized and has been repeated is very, very important and ought to have everyone's attention.
Well, it certainly has my attention and the Leak Project listeners. And I think it's good to question everything, yet still use discernment. And if you can find the evidence to show you what you need to come up with the conclusion, great, but don't take everything at face value. And even with the disclosure movement, I'm trying to figure out here. So what's the, I should take out the word trying, you know, looking for the data, where, what is this leading to? Or why are they telling us now? And as you said, you kind of see it as a possible B or C scenario, meaning that wasn't their first plan. But do you have any data suggesting that the ETs are now saying, look, we're going to show you who's boss, and it's us, it's not you?
No, I wouldn't say I have data showing that. If I compare what's happening now with what our ancestors told us way back in our ancestral narratives, in our world mythologies, the picture seems to be of a number of ET demographics who seem to feel that they have a stakeholding in Project Earth and Project Humanity. And they, I suppose the language, if I go to the language of the Bible, they are in something called a Sky Council, what Hamashed calls an intergalactic federation. And on that group, it seems there has been an agreement of non-disclosure, that the presence of all of them is to be kept essentially behind closed doors. Now, that doesn't mean that they don't have hands-on involvement in our story, far from it, but that they sort of police each other in keeping themselves off the front page of the New York Times. But all through history, there appear to be phenomena suggesting that that is not a watertight agreement. And in fact, the earliest text in the Bible that most people spot that has to do with the ET presence is Genesis 6. And that's a moment when the second wave of ETs that our ancestors remember turn up to do hybridization. There's some breach of the non-disclosure right there, and it creates a huge stink and a conflict among these demographics, these ET demographics. And that huge stink can be found in narratives all around the world. And so you can see that when this agreement of non-disclosure is breached, it's a problem for them. So what I think we're seeing now is that that nice, tight agreement to be invisible, albeit involved, it's not very watertight at the moment. And so, as we said at the top, my question is, which is the demographic that's pushing this forward? Because there's a spectrum of demographics that our ancestors tell us about, some who are here because they care about humanity, some who are here because they want some of what we've got in their gene pool, some who are here because of things the planet can offer them, some who are cold and indifferent towards us, treat us like cattle, and others who don't like us at all. And so the $64,000 question is, which of these are the ones who are pushing the agenda forward at the moment? Which of these are the ones who are creating the pressure so that we've got so much of our Plan B and Plan C disclosures out in the mix?
And who is it? Which ones?
I don't know. I'm saying that's the question.
Dang it.
But I would say I find it reassuring that there is that spectrum and that there has been a fair degree of stability over the thousands of years that our ancestors have carried this story. So, you know, I know that we've had a couple of presidents who talked about arming planet Earth against alien invasions. I'm thinking about Ronald Reagan, of course, back in the 80s with his SDI initiative. And then more recently, we had Donald Trump talking about the Space Force, which seems to be a reiteration of the same thing. I'm not sure how confident I am in that technology. And I might be more hopeful that there are others who've come here from somewhere else who are on the lookout for us, who might have even better tech than us. Having said that, I suspect that we as Earthlings have far better tech than the general public may have been told about. And I just raise an eyebrow when I remember Ed Mitchell, who clearly had information that he was not allowed to disclose. It's incredible what he could say while still bound by layers of official secrets laws, but he seemed to be confident that we could actually stand up in an intergalactic council and say, this is our planet. And I'd be really interested to know what his grounds for that confidence were. And it might be to do with our allegiance, our agreements with some of these more benevolent species who are part of the mix.
Well, see, and that might make sense as far as having some treaties, but here's the million-dollar question. If you're an intergalactic species that can travel the stars and time and space, essentially, what in the hell do you need to abduct people for and take their DNA? Because you'd be able to replicate it yourself with most likely. I mean, a very high percentile that you would. Not 100%, but most likely. Your thoughts?
It's very, very intriguing. It's a great question. Why would an advanced species come here in the first place? Why would they be interested in us, who presumably are more primitive? Why would they want to hybridize with us? Again, I think the evidence is that there might be a range of answers to that question. Now, the stories curated by our ancestors talk about hybridization in a way that suggests our visitors like what we have. There is something unique and attractive about human beings that they want in their gene pool. That's the Genesis 6 story. It says the Bene Elohim, the second wave of ETs, found human females very attractive And they wanted some of that action. Thank you very much. That's part of the story. And if you listen to the ancient iterations of that story, you can go down the eastern seaboard of Africa, down to the southern cone, up the western seaboard, into the Caribbean, as far east as the Philippines, into the Nordic countries. You go out to India, into the Celtic regions, Scotland, Wales, Ireland. They all have iterations of this story that talk about people being taken by another presence that looks very human but is not human. And they get taken to underwater bases. This is the story all around the world that gets told. And they're kept for a few years to be used for hybridization, and then they get returned. And often they're returned healthier than when they left. It's a very bizarre story. It doesn't relate to any human pattern of behavior. It's not a version of what we do in terms of sex trafficking or slave trading. It's something quite different. That story suggests there's something amazing about us, which I don't find that hard to believe, because we are a unique fusion of earthling and ET. We've got animal strength, we've got mammal emotion, and we've got higher consciousness. And I wonder if the blend that we are on planet Earth has made us a species with a very unique capacity for love, compassion, creativity, that we actually lead more pleasurable and more interesting lives because of the blend that we are. And I think our attractiveness is one of the reasons we've got the attention of our neighbors. But then there's a much darker strand of human abduction stories, especially if you listen to the more contemporary accounts. And then when you go into the whole question of what are they doing to our animals, you know, cutting them up into pieces and taking chunks of them away, that doesn't sound too good. And if you start listening to the report of some who have experiences, sometimes that they will report after the event, and sometimes that they will remember when in regression situations. So, for instance, there's the 50 personnel that Professor Mack examined when he was doing that study for US Defense, and they remember a far darker, more disturbing story. That suggests to me we've got a whole range of people interested in interfering with human beings for all kinds of different reasons. When you look into other stories of abductions, particularly of children, there is a much darker aspect to that. And I think that what we know of what human beings do when we abduct each other is really just a shadow of what some of our ET neighbors do. So again, I think there's a whole spectrum of agendas in our ancient past and happening right now.
Now, with the ETs that might come from, let's say that they come from Mars. And I think there's a lot of evidence that suggests that, especially if you look at Egypt, if you look at El Kaira in Egypt, the definition is Camp of Mars. If you look at the face on Mars from the 1976 orbiter, that is absolutely a face. There's no question. And there's all sorts of pyramids around it. And then they tried to debunk it later, and they're like, look at this fluffy video. If you look at the angle like this and you change the shadow like that, then you see that it might just be pareidolia. It's like, dude, come on. Come on. You know, it's clearly a freaking head. So, and it looks Egyptian, right? So I wonder how much of there's like a connection. They went to Mars, something happened, and they jump ship, they go to Earth. And like you said, they're like, dude, these chicks are hot. Let's stay here. Like, yeah, man, if they're not going to let us back up. Like, yeah, it's all right. We'll stay here. And now, I mean, it's like it seems like these bloodlines go back to the ancient pharaohs, and a lot of these leaders of today seem to have the blood of the gods.
Oh, wow. There's heaps in that question. My goodness. First of all, yes, there are ancient narratives that suggest there was a population on Mars, and that population might have come here. And I do wonder if our slowness in getting to Mars, I mean, goodness me, it is more than 50 years ago that we first landed on the moon. How on earth has it taken us this long to get to Mars? I wonder if part of the answer to that is, how do we manage finding evidence that there was a population, and maybe a human population, on Mars in the distant past, or an Anunnaki population? on Mars in the distant past. So I don't find that hard to believe. The other part of your question about bloodlines is so intriguing. I don't have any privileged information on this because I'm not a royal myself, but everybody knows that from the get-go, royalty has had this great obsession in keeping their bloodlines pure, so that a royal cannot marry an ordinary human being. That's just accepted. I remember when I was a boy being read the story of the Princess and the Pea, which the whole basis of that fairy tale, I think it was one of Grimm's fairy tales, is that royalty cannot marry ordinary human beings. Goodness only knows what would happen if that were to go down. And it's just so intriguing. You know, lately we've had William and Kate marry, Harry and Meghan marry. And at first we think, oh, isn't that lovely? They've married lovely, ordinary girls, you know, one of us, commoners. And then the press do a little bit of digging and no, they've got royal blood in them. And you might say, Meghan Markle, royal blood? Yep, absolutely. And is that an accident? No, it's not an accident. So what is that about? And what does ordinary human being mean from a royal perspective? And you take it right back to the beginning. And of course, we have in so many cultures around the world, the story that says that in the beginning, humans were governed by another species. They were governed by the gods. They were governed by advanced beings at Ragnarok or advanced beings on Mount Olympus, or they were governed by the Anunnaki or the ones who engineer in the Mesoamerican story. And then at some point, governance is handed over to human kings and queens. And we can see this transition on the Sumerian kings list. There's a crossover king, King Gilgamesh, who's a hybrid being. And you can see the crossover being in the Hebrew story with King Saul, the first human king over the people of God in that story. And sometimes the handover is peaceable and sometimes it's a hot mess. And in the case of the Hebrew story, it's a hot mess. But as soon as human royalty is installed by these non-human rulers, where that bloodline goes has been closely controlled ever since. And that ought to raise a couple of eyebrows.
It should. And let's take the ego out of the mindset. Let's, you know, so if it's not ego, then why is it so important? And billionaires use astrologers more than millionaires do.
Yes, that is really intriguing because I remember when I was a boy, Jimmy Carter was the president. And I'm a fan of his. I really think America didn't know what it had in President Carter. And I think it was a shame he didn't get a second term. But I do know that from him onwards, I've lost half your audience now by saying that, but I know that from him
I don't know
onwards,
enough about him to even say anything, so.
Well, I would say that President Carter, whatever people thought of him at the time, has really grown in stature in all the decades since. And I think people probably go back and listen to what he was doing and saying in a very different light to what we heard him in at the time. But anyway, history is what it is. It went from Carter to Reagan and the story rolls on. And all those presidencies, including the Carters, including the Reagans, who are card-carrying Christians, used astrologers and used them constantly. Now, what's so interesting about this is that it's part of a pattern of one set of information for the elite, one set of information for the rest of us. Just to illustrate it in really graphic terms, back in the days of Elizabeth I of England, if you were practicing witchcraft, you could expect to be executed for it, unless you were doing it for the crown. And Elizabeth I set up MI5, our first intelligence agency, and we know the paper records are there. The part of the assignment of MI5 was to develop skills that the wider community called witchcraft, and in particular, the skills of remote viewing, and also attempts to mind control your enemy. So here's something that's being used in secret, privately, by intelligence. And now that doesn't sound so different to what intelligence agencies do in the 21st century. You've got that information there that's being used because it's known that there's some power to these methods. But in the public, oh no, this is unacceptable. We're a Christian country. We execute people for doing that. And so we come to the 20th century, if we're going to talk about Carter and Reagan, and there's that split still. You're not going to find evangelical Christians in the wider community consulting an astrologer for their every decision. Go to your evangelical president, different story, because they have other information about these modalities and methods and how useful they are.
Absolutely. And was it Elizabeth that had John Dee working with her for, or was that after?
Yes, no, that's exactly right. He was the man. And he was the guy who was in charge of a very small department tasked with remote viewing. Now, what's so interesting about that? You think, why would they do that? Why would MI5 want to have a magic department? Well, the answer is that back in the day, there was not a lot of money for getting undercover agents in the capital cities of your enemies all around the world. But you want to know what they're doing. You want to know what they're thinking. Is there some way we can get that information without actually having to have boots in the field? And really, every government from that time to this has asked that question. We've developed technology to do it, but we still employ our military, our intelligence agencies still employ people to develop remote viewing for the exact same reason it was being done 500 years ago.
Well, that's deep. That's deep. And I had a Navy SEAL on recently, retired Navy SEAL, that has his own version of remote viewing. And it's not military protocols or like what certain people do that were trained to not even know what their target was. He does remote viewing where he knows what the target is already versus getting a slip that has a number on it. And then you remote view that and it's something on Mars or something in the ocean or something along those lines. But you know what somebody just said in the comments section? I don't know if it's your take on this. And Sweeps, I think, is actually, she's in the chat right now. She's putting together a really cool book also. She says all the founders were into the occult. And then she says something about how it's because the gifts are passed down by bloodlines.
Ah, yes. Look, I think there is a lot to do with that, that there are capacities that are carried genetically. So bloodlines are relevant for that reason. Also, if you read our ancient texts, and then if you listen to contemporary lore, it's quite clear that our ET visitors, those who observe us, are also very interested in bloodlines. And so after publishing Escaping from Eden, I've had people contacting me every week. Some weeks it's every day, with experiences they want to share with me. And often they'll be experiences they've absolutely kept to themselves. And more than once I've had someone say to me, I'm sharing this with you because I still need to process what happened. I've told my wife about it. I've talked to the person I was with when it happened. And I haven't told another living, breathing soul in the 50 years since it happened. And so these are mature people. And often they tell me, just after they've retired and they've got the time to reflect a bit on their lives and think, I really need to tie up some loose ends here. And so from time to time, people would tell me about encounters that they've had, close encounters of various kinds. And I've learned to say, did your parents experience anything like this? And time again, many of them will say, no, I don't think so. And then a week later, they'll say, I talked to my dad and he's opened up about something that happened to him when he was 20 years old. And I found out that my grandmother as well. And here's the story that emerges. Generation after generation of a particular bloodline is being observed. And if you drill further into stories of women who come and they say, I've had close encounters, that my memories of them suggest to me I've been used in a hybridization program. Very often those are stories that go back generation by generation. And so, yes, I think that does relate to what we were talking before about ETs keeping an eye on the royal bloodlines and why that should be. And then when we come to higher cognitive abilities, yes, there's a genetic component to that and how that's carried from generation to generation. My ears pricked up when I heard about this remote viewing thing in the context of intelligence, because I had just been reading about it in the Popol Vuh, which is the Mayan account of human origins. And according to that account, which is ages old, we all have that potential. Now, you and I know we've got these wonderful, enormous brains that we seem to be just using a fraction of. And from time to time, we might ask, oh, what would it be like if we were able to turn all of that on and use all of that? Well, the Popol Vuh says that in the beginning, our ancestors could remote view as a matter of course, had abilities in precognition because they were wired that way. And that at some point in our development as a species, we were actually dumbed down to lose those abilities, dumbed down to the point where our perceptual field is just our five physical senses so that we could be more easily managed. But the Mayan tradition and shamanic and mystical traditions all around the world have, from time immemorial, aimed at switching those capacities back on. So you speak to the shaman, he's worked out how to switch it on and he can remote view. And he could teach you to do the same. And as a minister, because I was in Christian ministry for 33 years in congregational ministry, very often you'll find pastors engage in this as best they can. They get glimpses of precognition, glimpses of telepathic connection, glimpses of remote viewing. And we kind of learn to be open to those things, because if you are simply restricted to your five senses and you're having to counsel people, you're going to be really limited. You're always wanting to sense what's really going on here. You walk into an emergency situation, what's really going on here? You walk into a house that's experiencing paranormal disturbance as a priest or a pastor. You've got to work out what's really going on here. And so pastors tend to be quite interested in these random things that they pick up. And before I started writing Escaping from Eden, I began realizing that these abilities are not just ministry abilities. They're not just gifts that priests and pastors happen to have. All human beings have these potentialities, and I believe we can all develop them. Not that we would all want to work for the CIA or MI5 or Queen Elizabeth I, but that we can be a little bit more awake and a little bit more aware of what's going on around us than we generally are.
So, yeah, that's interesting. More like the metaphysical aspects that might not be as easily duplicated. But even if you go there, let's go there for a minute. These extraterrestrial beings that could have technologies that allow them to travel through the stars, you would think that they could have a nano chip embedded in their eyeball that allowed them to pick up brain waves and transfer that into the, you know, like translate it into their voice or just pick it up. But you know, once again, that's speculation. I mean, that's pure speculation, and to speculate that a species that can travel through time and space wouldn't need our DNA because they could just replicate everything. I mean, you can look at Occam's razor and stuff like that to get to that conclusion to an extent, but still, we just, it seems like there's something more, like something spiritual.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. There are two ways you can look at that. First of all, you don't have to speculate too far to get onto the territory you were just describing if you're willing to listen to the report of people who claim close encounters. Because very often people are aware that their consciousness has been manipulated, that they were made to see something that was not real. that they've been given a masking memory, that the thing they perceived interacting with them was not how that thing really looked. All these aspects, or when one person is taken and another person can't be roused, consciousness has been manipulated. Or when a person comes back and says, I can remember the first few seconds of something happening, I have no idea what happened next. Once again, consciousness has been manipulated, whether that's through advanced brain power or through some nano chip in the eye, or however you want to describe it, there is that capacity there. But then when you come to us and our higher capacities, I think we shouldn't assume that our super abilities of telepathic connection, remote viewing, precognition, that they must be our ET bit, and they've been added to our animal bit. That might be a false assumption, because I think dogs are better remote viewers than human beings. My cat can see things I can't see. Any cat owner will tell you that. Birds have a better sense of direction than I have. And it just might be that our animal heritage fused with our ET element means that actually human beings have a sensitivity that our neighbors don't have. And if we're going to talk in the language of spirituality, maybe we have a whole heap of capacity for that, that again, our neighbors don't have. If, again, we're willing to listen to the report of people who've encountered, say, beings that get described as small greys, it seems to me that they're describing beings that do not have the sophistication of thought and emotion that we have. There's something almost robotic about the way those creatures operate. And they're just one of a number of demographics. Maybe there are some out there who are far more spiritual and emotional and profound than we are. But, you know, I think we tend to, when we talk about populated universe, we tend to assume that we're somewhere down at the bottom of the ranking just because we don't have, or we think we don't have, the best tech. And I think that's a false assumption.
Well, for example, I know many people that have had lifelong experiences abducted by these greys, and their family as well, you know, like their parents and their grandparents and their kids and their brothers and sisters. It's fascinating. And the one thing, though, that certain people might not question is, so these ETs, their IQ, like you said, doesn't seem as high as ours. It seems like they're in a collective hive mind, right? So how the hell how are they making spaceships that can fly through time and space if they can't even put your clothes back on the right way? So there's a missing component here. Yes. And so when you, even if you use the term Anunnaki, that's like those that come from the heavens, those that come from space. So they could come from anywhere. You could even have people coming from Earth that lived through a cataclysmic event that increased their technologies, that have spaceships, and they say, "Hey, we come from the heavens." Where they, you know, they could be from Antarctica for all that we know. So I think it's a combination of all of the above. But when you look at these grays in particular, they could have very easily been designed. And I'm not saying they're not alive, and I'm not saying they don't have some levels of consciousness and maybe even, you know, levels of the soul. Because if you have consciousness, I think that's a part of the soul. Maybe different layers of soul and different levels of consciousness throughout different beings, but that's a whole other podcast. So they seem to be genetically altered to be in an environment of space, of a spaceship. And like they could be taking orders from something that we still don't know what they are.
Yes, that's very possible. And if there's an intergalactic federation, then we don't know the details of the relationship between different demographics. You know, is one demographic here, as you say, taking orders from another? And I have had some who've experienced small greys who do believe they are at least well suited to taking orders, if not actually adapted for that purpose, and who've actually found some purchase in trying to take control of situations where they've got small greys around them, and found that they had a bit more clout and authority than they thought they did. So I find that very intriguing. So it does give the impression that those guys just might be the foot soldiers for somebody else.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Especially if these things are like a far, far away, they could communicate with them. You've read the stories about how the Anuna gods or the Anunnaki had to leave because, or they actually, the ones that I'm thinking of, there's a Sumerian tablet that describes how the Anuna gods, which are the Anunnaki, they prostrated themselves to this, like this thunderbird or something like that, which makes me think of this major plasma event, this major solar flare. And so they're like, we got to get the hell out of here because this is a cosmic event. So as much power as they have, they still had to jump ship because of the cataclysms.
Absolutely. I mean, they are still beings. They're not gods. They're not cosmic beings. They are just neighbors with more advanced tech and spacefaring abilities. And you're quite right to point out earlier that this word Anunnaki, some have suggested it might be more helpful to translate that as astronauts, because Anunnaki isn't a species. It just says they're not from here, or they've arrived from the skies. And so the word Anunnaki could refer to all kinds of different demographics.
Yes, and so the recent the Vatican nativity scene, and you can go directly to the Vatican News and see this, the nativity scene, they've got an astronaut that looks like a Sumerian astronaut and a medieval knight in their nativity scene. Did you see that?
I have not seen that, Rex. That's extraordinary. Do you know any more about that?
Yeah, let me pull it up real quick. So I'll pull it up, and while I'm doing that, Tell us a little bit more about Escaping Eden and like why you, the information you've put together, why we were made, why we're here, who made us, etc.
Sure. Well, Escaping from Eden is really topical right now because we've got Haim Ashed, the former chief of the Israeli space security program, saying there is an intergalactic federation. They are in contact, but they're not disclosing. And that's the language he uses. And Escaping from Eden argues that that concept is there, hidden in plain sight in the pages of the Bible. It's not quite in plain sight because of some translation decisions that were made in the 6th century BCE concerning a word, the word Elohim. And the word Elohim is one of the words that gets translated as God in the Bible. I argue that if we take its root meaning, which is the powerful ones, what emerges is the story of an intergalactic federation, a number of different ET demographics arriving on planet Earth with different agendas. And the first agenda we hear about is in the first two sentences of Genesis. They have turned up to rehabilitate a planet that's been devastated and largely flooded. So the first ET intervention is a benevolent one. And then we get a little bit further in and we realize there are conflicts among these ET visitors, because in Genesis 3, we've got one demographic that wants to upgrade the human beings to have a greater capacity for intelligence and consciousness, and another demographic wanting to keep us so unintelligent that we don't even know we're naked. So keep us at an animal level. Now, in between those two stories, we appear on the scene, and you can go to Genesis or you can go to the ancestral narratives of cultures all around the world, and they will talk about how we were developed by another species. Plato argued this 2,500 years ago. He believed that our ancestors were on the planet peacefully, quietly evolving, and then some visitors turned up and genetically modified us and adapted us. And it's the story of those adaptations that you can find in Genesis and the Popol Vuh and the Sumerian stories, and indeed all around the world. And then once we're on the scene, they continue to argue with each other about what we should do with the human beings. How many should there be on the planet? How long lived should they be? Are we going to put up with, let's just get rid of them all. No, I want to rescue some of them. And there's all this to-ing and fro-ing, all about human progress. In Genesis 11, an ET presence turns up that decides we don't want a weaponized human race, and we don't want a space-faring human race. Let's bomb them back into the Stone Age. And so we're bombed back into a condition where we have to re-evolve the power of speech. And so the human race is really caught in the crossfire of sometimes very violent conflicts among these beings who turn up from somewhere else. And the language in the Bible is Elohim, Bene Elohim. The Popol Vuh talks about those who engineer. Other language is used all around the world. And every culture has an iteration, an expression of this story.
Wow, man. As above, so below. As in heaven, as it is on earth. It makes you think that they set their dynasties here. So, you know, they're doing work up there. They bring it down here. They bring down certain governments and certain control systems and networks. And if we have the same DNA they do, well, we've got that connection. Like you said, some people want to help us. Some people want to destroy us. And one thing that worries me a little bit, especially with this new age of Aquarius that we're going into, some people say that's an air sign. And some people think that that's going to allow the return of like a new religion, which is going to be connected to air. And Enlil is the god of air. And Enlil is the one that was like, okay, you know, there's too many of them down there. All they're doing is having sex and causing problems. And let's just flood the hell out of them. That kind of spooks me out a bit, dude. Because you just brought up something, too. They're trying to decide how many of us they want on this planet. Well, how about the 500 million? No more than 500 million. Well, there's a few more than 500 million. So maybe they'll just invite us onto a bunch of spaceships and send us off to Mars to build some underground cities out there. Or maybe.
Yeah, it is a bit worrying. And, I mean, you only have to listen to some of our human leaders to know that the question of how many human beings they want on the planet has remained a live question from that time to this. But it's an interesting question as to the story of Enlil and Enki. The story is told that they are part of the same species. They have different agendas, but they are the same species. They are described as being brothers. Enlil is, well, you could say god of the air, or you could translate it as the space commander. And then Enki is the Earth commander, so he's junior to Enlil, and they're the ones who conflict in the Sumerian stories about how intelligent humans should be, how healthy, how long-lived, and how many there should be. But what did happen to them? Did they leave? Did they just go undercover? Did they leave and keep the means of control? Because if you compare that with what we do when we invade each other's countries, once we've set the commodity prices and set up the banks and exchange rates, we can really go home and still benefit from sitting at the top of the economic tree in these other people's country. Is that what the Anunnaki did, that they went home but they're somehow still benefiting? Or are those stories really from a long, long distant time? Because the Sumerians are telling stories of stuff that happened long before their own time. So are they elsewhere? Are they extinct? The current presence is something else? Are they present, but, you know, via vice regents and deputies? In which case, they don't need to return. If they never went away, they don't need to return either. And so maybe something else is happening. Maybe some other faction is coming further forward in the mix right now.
Like what?
Well, I'm intrigued just by how untidy this moment is. So I do think there's actually some pressure on the current arrangement. And the fact that we've amped up our plan B and plan C looks like there's some uncertainty at the covert levels of government as to how this thing is going to play out. And I don't say that to terrify people. I'm not terrified. Humanity has lived through some incredible things, and I think our neighbors probably have as well, and we're not in this alone. But I would just say there's some uncertainty as to what might be unfolding in the months even and years to come.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I want to change subject a little bit in reference to where they come from. I've questioned the, you know, they come from a planet around the star Sirius. I've questioned them even possibly being light beings from Sirius at one point and having a different vibrational frequency now, or maybe even the same. But where am I going to go with this? Nibiru has been talked about by Zachariah Sitchin. And I've been looking for other, like I've read probably over 100 or approximately 100 tablets that were translated from Oxford and various sources. And I've only read a half book by Zachariah Sitchin, and that was his first book. And there was a few things in there that I disagreed with, but I'm not saying I'm right or he's wrong. But I when he was talking about the May, if you know what the May is, right? Or you've heard of the May and these Sumerian tablets, right? The M-E, but it's always in italics or it's... So I think that's us. I think that's like DNA. That's my opinion. But anyway, so I love Zachariah Sitchin, and I think that he brought a lot of awareness about the Anunnaki to the people. And I don't like it when people give him a hard time or like, well, he was a Freemason, so what? And or he was this, or he was, you know, he worked for them, or nah. I think he genuinely believed what he presented. And I appreciate that. But I've not found anything on Nibiru outside of him. I found Nibiru, yeah. But not Nibiru. Yeah. I found like Nibiru, which I think was a place in ancient Babylon or something.
Well, yes, I think you could find the word that he's on about, that he's identified. But what it represents is for me a question. Now, when I started researching for Escaping from Eden, my route into the whole topic was I'd been preaching from the Bible for 33 years, and I thought, I need to drill down into some of the anomalies here. And I did that. I found another story that was sort of hidden in plain sight, and it's led me onto the territory of paleo contact, ET contact, and ET intervention in our evolution. That was my way in. And it was while I was researching the book that I actually became aware of Zachariah Sitchin. I'd never heard of him before a few years ago when I started doing my own research. And when I became aware of him, I thought, oh, blow, someone else has thought this before. Should I quickly read up on all his books before I do any more research? And I thought, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to follow my own logic. I'm going to do my own research. And then if it lines up with what Sitchin says or these other people say, then that's interesting. Because on our own, we've come to the same conclusions and we're sort of confirming one another. So that's the route I took. And then as I became more aware of Sitchin's work, first of all, I take my hat off to Zachariah Sitchin because you're quite right. Nobody gets everything 100% right. And there may be things that debunkers can pick up on in Zechariah Sitchin's work and say, he got that wrong, or he didn't know that, did he? Or I don't like the way he's got no references here, it's all a bit vague. That's all very well, but he broke the taboo over the Mesopotamian stories. He is the one who made everyone aware, have to acknowledge that the Mesopotamian stories are about sky people. It's there in the narratives themselves. You don't have to endorse every bit of translation that Sitchin proposes to see how the story plays out in the cuneiform tablets. And in fact, when I wrote Escaping from Eden, I made a deliberate choice to use only the most widely accepted translations of the Sumerian, Babylonian, Akkadian, and Assyrian cuneiforms, because I didn't want people saying, that's an off translation, you can't build an argument on that. I took only the broadly accepted translations and I said, well, let's read that story and let's reflect on what happens. And I think it absolutely affirms the great bulk of what Zechariah Sitchin had to offer. But like you, Rex, I take a different view of Nibiru because I did not become persuaded in my reading of the cuneiforms that Nibiru is another planet that from time to time invades our solar system's space. My reading of the text is that our space-faring visitors had craft that could move them around. They had, I believe, a stargate, at least one, that they could operate, and they had space stations. And I believe Nibiru was the main space station. I don't think it was a planet. I think it was the mother space station from which all the other craft came and to which the other craft were dispatched. Now, I might be wrong about that, but I base that just on how the stories play out, at what we're told about the action. So that's my conclusion there. So a little bit different. It's not a hugely significant difference when you think, come on, what's the big picture here? What are we actually being told about our place in the universe? But it would be one point where I depart a little bit from what Sitchin said.
There's a lot of people I've talked to that have the same theory about Nibiru being a spaceship and it being the mothership. And that's a possibility. That's a great possibility. Great possibility. And also the crossing. So it could be a timeline. It could be like a solar event or a change in the cosmic clock. There's so many possibilities. I like the mothership possibility. One thing that I find interesting about some of the tablets that he was trying to say was Nibiru is there's a lot of information about Saturn that maybe at one point Saturn was a star. And if you look at Iapetus, it totally looks artificial. Mimas totally looks artificial. The rings are so mysterious. And there's the Ringmakers of Saturn. Excellent, excellent book. I still don't understand it fully. But if Saturn was a planet and somehow they were able to, or not a planet, of course it's a planet. Derp, is Saturn a planet, man? Bob? If it was a star at one point, and then they figured out a way to like harness it, like you've heard of the Dyson sphere theory. Well, what if the rings are a Dyson sphere, man? And they're like, they're tapping into that energy. Have you considered that possibility?
Well, what I find really intriguing is that I think in our world mythologies, we've got memories that belong to our own civilization. And then I think we've got memories that go much further back, whether they've been things told to us by visitors or that belong to previous civilizations here on planet Earth prior to the ones we know about. And these memories do seem to have some very odd things to say about Saturn. And in fact, many of the ancient stories of the gods seem to be interpretations of something really cosmic happening around Saturn. Saturn is sometimes fused with the idea of the god who's in charge of everything. Well, that's rather odd, isn't it? Why isn't that the sun? Why would it be Saturn and not the sun? Where's the logic to that? And so the inference can be made that what was happening with Saturn was so significant, cosmically speaking, that it seemed to be having a more direct bearing on what was happening on planet Earth than even the sun. So what on earth could that possibly be? And what you're talking about, I think, relates to that. If it's actually a star that's become a planet and a planet that's become captured or a planet that's been managed or a planet that has wormholes around it. And there are suggestions that that there are wormholes around Saturn, and we're beginning to detect the evidence for that when we look at the electromagnetic properties of our solar system. So I haven't been able to put those pieces together and say, Rex, I've solved the problem. Here's the answer. Here's the coherent picture. But there are all these strange things that keep pointing us back to Saturn to say, Saturn is not what it used to be. And Saturn has played a role on planet Earth that our ancestors knew about that we don't. And so I would just say that's something I really need to look further into and research up on. I think there's heaps for us to remember concerning what Saturn is.
Great. And you know so much about mythology. Let me just kind of throw a couple of breadcrumbs your way. Shamash is the ancient sun god. And then Utu became the new sun god, but many scholars say they're one and of the same. I would argue that Shamash was Saturn when it was activated as the sun, and Utu is actually the sun that we see now in the sky. And that if you look at Saturn, Saturday. Jewish worship is Friday through Saturday. And you look at the Teflon, which is a cube that they wear through worship sometimes. And the Teflon reminds me of the cube of Saturn. And Shema is in the Teflon, but it means something else. I know somebody that's Jewish, that, and I made a theory that Shema had something to do with Shamash, and he said, no, it doesn't, but I'll still let you pass anyway. So you'll get a pass, Rex. I said, thanks, man. But anyway, so I think there's something to all that.
There's something going on there.
Yeah. Definitely. So, Ed, you know, maybe you could do some more research on that. We could collaborate in the future. Because,
oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Yes, we should talk further about that. I was prompted just recently, again on this topic, when I was looking at some of the stories of Central and South America, because in the Andes, there's this story of Viracocha. And Viracocha was a figure in their mythology who, a bit like the feathered serpent, Quetzalcoatl, in the Mayan story, he was a figure who turned up and was involved in engineering our ancestors. But as anthropologists went in and started researching the Viracocha stories, it was clear that they'd got mixed up at some point with an almighty God concept. And it wasn't just through the arrival of Roman Catholicism, which deliberately confused Viracocha with God. Before that happened, they had fused the stories of Viracocha with stories of Saturn. So again, they're identifying Saturn with the God who influences and controls things on planet Earth. So again, it raises the question, what was Saturn doing that it was perceived as the most powerful influence on our planet when we've got the sun just down the road? So that caught my attention, and I thought there's heaps I've got to find out about this.
Yeah. And then you take the Vatican and the sun in our solar system now, and the references of Jesus being the only son, you know, the only begotten son of the Father. And then they say the only way through the Father is through me in the Bible. And I'm thinking is the sun of Stargate. But if you look at even the back, like the courtyard of the Vatican, it's a sun, man. It's sun worship. So then you've got the Freemasons and their connection with Venus. And then you hear people say, oh, they worship Lucifer. Well, astrotheologically speaking, Lucifer and Venus are the same. And then the Muslim religion is strongly connected with moon worship, in my opinion, astrotheologically speaking. So you get different religions and their worship, like their ancient planet worship.
Well, the Vatican, you know, I would love to spend a little holiday in the Vatican Library, because we talked before about different information for the elites and different information for the public. And one of the ways that pattern has grown up is that when, let's take, for instance, the invasion of Central and South America, when the Catholic forces of Portugal and Spain went into Central and South America, they confiscated the ancient texts that had other accounts of who we are and where we all came from, and burnt them, executed the priesthoods, and I guess the best copies got sent back to the King of Spain, the King of Portugal, and to His Holiness the Pope. So there'll be libraries somewhere that have books like that in them. And every time we invade and we take control of the news, the local information, the local memory gets sequestered, taken away, and it becomes archived. And I don't think it's any great secret to say that there's all sorts of material like that in the Vatican libraries that has been studied through the centuries. And some of the greatest scholars of the Roman Catholic tradition are people who are right across not only ancient mythologies, but ancient technology. And that information, where does it go? Now, other than the copies that get sent back to the Vatican and the King of Spain and the King of Portugal, there are the copies that get buried and protected by secret societies of priests. So that's why the Popol Vuh resurfaced 200 years later and got translated into Spanish by the Dominican priest Francisco Jimenez. Think about the Gnostic Gospels. It's the same story. Once this narrow Christian orthodoxy had become the official story of the empire, all the other stories were taken off the shelves, no longer taught, and buried for their protection. And so the Nag Hammadi Desert becomes the repository of all these texts that have been buried for their protection. Only a few priests know where they're buried. And so those are the roots of esoteric traditions, secret societies of priests who know where the texts are buried and know what they say. And so for a couple of thousand years at least, we've had secret societies curating secret knowledge and information. And so you talk about Freemasonry, that's an obvious example, but there are plenty of other secret societies that curate the secret information, and those secrets are set with religious groups, and so they operate within churches or within intelligence agencies even. And so that's again another place that that information goes. And what's so interesting about that strand of information is that it does get leaked back to the public from age to age, and often it gets leaked back through works of art, through novels, through screenplays. And sometimes people become aware of it through other means. If you talk to George Lucas and you get him relaxed enough, he might suggest to you that some of the information about Mimas and Iapetus was channeled information. He didn't get it from a secret book. It was something that was channeled. And that may or may not be the case. It's something I've heard. But I certainly believe that writers do sometimes get privileged information through sources like secret societies. They may even be part of them. If you think of Edgar Rice Burroughs, Rudyard Kipling, they would be examples of that. Gene Roddenberry, another example. And then there's channeled information. And Gene Roddenberry was somebody who absolutely had both tracks available to him. And so that's often how we, the general public, pick up on these stories, and why, when we start hearing ancestral knowledge or official stories get leaked, we think, hang on, didn't I see this in a movie? Well, yes, you did. It was leaked. And that's led me to the belief that there's far less fiction in the world than we generally think, both contemporary fiction and when we go to our ancient stories too.
The original Death Stars, Iapetus, yeah, and Mimas. Totally, man.
It's so obvious, even NASA has to acknowledge the similarity on its website.
Yeah, it was the first time I saw Iapetus, it just blew my mind. That was one of the game changers for me, where I said, man, there is no question that there's stuff out there. I mean, an entire moon! I mean, that's going to blow anybody's mind.
I did. I gave that huge, great, long answer, by the way, an answer to your question about these things. If you go to the Vatican and you start seeing designs and stuff that don't seem to relate to any Christian story, I was explaining they relate to other information they have.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And so I want to ask you, in finishing up here, I got to say, this has been awesome. So thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to hang out here with us at Leak Project.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
You're a co-host for a great YouTube channel in partnership with Gaia called FifthKind.tv.
That's right. FifthKind.tv is our website. And you can find the Fifth Kind TV on YouTube as well. But if you want the full uncensored stuff, go to FifthKind.tv. And yes, I do that with Anthony Barrett. He's based in the UK. I'm in Australia, and we're the collaboration.
Yeah, and then you've also got the website. So if you tell us a little bit about your website.
So if you go to paulantonywallace.com, so that's Anthony with an H, Wallace, W-A-L-L-I-S, paulantonywallace.com, you can keep up with everything I'm doing, with the books that are coming. There it is, the new one due out April 2021, The Scars of Eden, which goes even wider and even more deeply into our ancestral narratives and brings us right up to date with what's been happening in the last few months. And it also drills down a bit into that question of why are our neighbors interested? What are their agendas? How does it relate to the geopolitics of the 21st century? So that's The Scars of Eden. And after Christmas, New Year, you should be able to pre-order that. Meanwhile, Escaping from Eden is going great guns. It's now officially an international bestseller, which I'm absolutely thrilled about. And if you want to contact me because you have a story you want to share, I'm very happy to hear from people that way. You can reach me through my website, paulanthonywallace.com. I have a YouTube channel of my own as well with a bit more of the spiritual content and stuff, and that's the Paul Wallace channel.
Right on. And you're going to send me an autographed copy when that comes out, right?
I certainly am.
Yes. Hello. Hello. Well, I'm going to read it and show it off. And, you know, this was even better than our first interview, man. And our first one was awesome.
Thanks, Rex. I love talking to you about these things. And you're so wonderfully and widely informed. We've got to talk again about the Saturn thing and see what we can find out.
Well, let's do it. And the electric universe hypothesis, you know, they're big. They are big believers, many of them, in the Saturn being a star. So that's a huge part of that theory. I mean, people like Wal Thornhill, absolutely genius. He's shared a lot of evidence. And if you look at some of the hieroglyphics of the gods and their headdresses, they've been able to compare that to the way that Saturn looked in the sky with Venus and Mars and very fascinating. And then the Perot instability stuff. So I would love to talk to you about that in the future. And
awesome.
Yeah. Can't wait for the
book. We should do a book together on it.
Yeah. Hello. That's what I'm talking about. Folks, I sent him a $5 check in the mail to say nice things about me. So yeah. $5.
the money is really valued, Rex. Thank you. But I'd say it anyway. I absolutely love your show. I love what you do. And you bring so much to the table for people to chew on. Thanks so much for having me on again. I'm going to be looking forward to the next time.
Me too. And folks, thank you for being here with us. Make sure to hit the bell. Be well. I'm going to leave the link so you can subscribe to Paul's channel also. And man, blessed and lucky to be here with all of you. So thank you everybody for watching this. I feel super honored and blessed and humble, and be the change you want to see, everybody. No, how do I hit the stop record here? There we go.